electrodes. They felt the need to select one being positive and one being negative. And, of course, they liked the positive going to the negative as the nomenclature for current. Now, a lot of places will blame, actually, Benjamin Franklin for this labeling. I don't know if that's apocryphal or absolutely true, but it was defined long before anyone knew about electrons or what electricity really was. And there's a long history of science making a 50-50 guess and getting it wrong. They discovered phlogiston, which is negative oxygen. And there's a whole list of them. And one of the things they got wrong was just the free-moving current is from a positively charged particle before they realized what an electron was.
I've also heard the story that Benjamin Franklin had a 50-50 chance of labeling one terminal of the battery positive and the other terminal negative. He had a 50-50 chance and got it wrong. I've heard that story. Along these lines, slightly related subject, you can have a lot of fun with your fellow scientists at Los Alamos, John. And a friend of mine is a scientist at the European Southern Observatory in La Salina, Chile. And he took his fellow astronomers and electronic engineers that were operating at that facility, and he gave him this puzzle I'm about to give you. Let me drop. Assume, theoretically, that you've got a fully charged car battery, your normal, very thick braid that goes between the car battery and the starter motor. And during the time the starter motor is cranking, your particular starter motor on a cold day draws 200 amperes. These are a bunch of assumptions, which are close to the reality on a cold winter day. Your locked rotor current might be as high as 200 amperes if you've got a really fresh, fully charged battery. And there's 3 feet of cable between that car battery and that starter motor. Now, here's the spooky part. Assume that all the electrons coming out of that battery are red, a correction, they're blue. And at one particular time, the very next electron coming out happens to be a red electron, and you're able to follow it. So during the time that the starter motor is engaged and is drawing 200 amperes, and you're watching that red electron flow out of the car battery's negative terminal, we're going to say, and you're watching it flow 3 feet away. Give me a rough guess, a rough order of magnitude. How long, on average, will it take for that red electron leaving the battery to get to the starter motor 3 feet away through that thick braid during the time the starter motor is drawing 200 amperes? How long will it take for that red electron to get there? AC2SHO, K2LIW. Go ahead, John. AC2SHO, K2LIW. Still there, John, or did I time it out?
No, you didn't time it out. I'm sorry, I didn't realize the question was for me. I believe I understood the question, though. Typically very close to the speed of light, but if anything like I understand of RF, there would be the a bit of delay just due to the propagation factor. I may not be completely on point there, but please let me know how I'm doing. K2RIW, KC2SHO.
AC2IS, comment.
Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, I keep on forgetting how to work out the answer to that problem, but I always remember that, you know, the numbers work out much larger than I expect. So I'm going to guess that, you know, you push an electron out, you've got a whole bunch of electrons in your wire going to the starter motor. So one electron will fall into your starter motor, essentially, right as one electron leaves the battery. But I think it's on the order of several hours before that one electron leaves the battery and gets to the starter motor, or it could actually be longer. Like I said, I just keep on forgetting, A, how to work out the answer to that problem, and B, what the order of magnitudes there really are. AC2IS.
Intuition.
Yeah, there's multiple answers to this question. If I had an on-off switch at the battery, at the instant I close that switch, because of 3 feet of cable, and the speed of light is a nanosecond per foot, 3 nanoseconds later, the starter motor is responding. So, from one point of view, I close the switch at the starter motor, at the battery, and the starter motor, by the way, I can have the switch on either end. At the instant I close the switch, current has to be flowing out of the battery, and in 3 milliseconds, and 3 microseconds, here we go, 3 nanoseconds, the starter motor is getting the energy required. However, the total amount of electrons in that fat cable between your battery and your starter motor is a huge number of electrons. And even though the charge on each one is 10 to the minus 19 coulombs, because there's such a large number of them, and you can calculate how many, if Mother Nature would let you do an unbalance, let me drop them. As Bill just mentioned, Mother Nature wants there to be a balance at all times. You take an electron out of the far end of the cable, she will not allow current to flow until you put an electron into the near end of the cable. You have to continuously make balance. But if Mother Nature would allow you to unbalance, even with no starter, with no battery there at all, if she would allow you to drain all the electrons out of that copper cable going to your starter motor, you could drain 200 amperes of worth of electrons, 10 to the 19 electrons, 200 times that. You could do that for 4 solid hours before you would drain all of the free flowing capable electrons in that copper cable. So on average, the answer is 4 hours. Of course, it sounds crazy, but you go through the mathematics of how many electrons are in that cable and what's their total amount of charge. Roughly 200 amperes for 4 hours. Go ahead, Wes, K2RIW.
Usually you take the diameter of the wire and divide the density of the electron in the copper wire. We talk about the copper wire. But usually it's 1 micron per hour for gauge 18. But funny thing is that information is immediate. I would like Dr. Roy to take center.
Yeah, we've already explained that. It's like marbles in a pipe. You take one marble at the far end, you're going to put a marble into the near end. So the signal can flow in 3 nanoseconds through 3 feet of cable because of this balance requirement that Mother Nature forces. But for that red electron coming out of the negative lead of the battery to go through that broad copper braid that goes to the starter motor, it takes 4 hours for that particular red electron to get there. Wes wanted Roy to make comments on this. AC2GS, K2RIW. Go ahead, Dr. Roy.
Yes, this is AC2GS. For anyone who is curious about this concept, you can simply Google the phrase electron drift. That's what they call it. Yes, the information travels at velocities close to, but not at the speed of light, but the actual electrons are slow as molasses. And I think electron drift is a great imagery word for the speed difference of electrons in a current.
WS2N, comment.
When we get back to you, Roy, you're going to have to back off on your audio just a little bit. The peaks of your audio are making a dropout on the machine. WS2N, K2RIW, go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, a fun experiment on showing the direction of the electrons. If you take two welding sticks, you put them in two separate spigots, and you create an arc between the two. If the normal way you're going to weld, let's say mild steel, you're going to have a positive and a negative. So they call that reverse polarity. What you're holding in your hand is positive, and the work is the negative. So if you put two electrodes, make the work one electrode and then the other one in your hand another electrode, and you arc the two, you set it up and you arc the two, and you spend some time, maybe about 20, 30 seconds, and then stop, you're going to find that the electrode that's in your hand, the positive one, it's worn down quite a bit, where the other one, the negative side is hardly worn down at all. If you reverse the polarity and create a situation where the one in your hand is now negative, and then the opposite side, the work side, is positive, you'll see that electrode will wear down. You go one step further, well, you'd have to change your welding rod, but you go one step further and you click it onto AC and do the same experiment, and you look at the two and you measure them, they come out exactly the same length. So you can tell that, you know, one is getting worn down because the electrons are blasting into the other side. Back to you, sir.
2IS, query.
Yeah, I've got a whole set of questions on this one, Paul. You've done a lot of welding for a lot of years. Under normal circumstances, you've got a great big clip lead that you put on the chunk of steel you're about to weld. That's the negative lead. And if I understand correctly, the positive lead is the one that you put the welding rod in and you start the welding process. If you all had the right equipment to reverse the process, if the positive lead was the ground to the chunk of steel, and the negative lead is now going to have a welding rod, and you started welding that way with a yellow rod is now negatively polarized, and the positive lead is grabbed chunk of steel, and you tried to do arc welding in that case, what would happen? What would the difference be, and what would happen, Paul? WS2N, T2IW?
Yeah, you would have a hard time burning up your electrode. You'd be sparking and sparking. It would be a tough time to... The idea is to burn up that electrode that's in your hand. So, you might be able to keep the arc going intermittently. Now, there's a purpose for it. I mean, on the welding machine, you have a switch which reverses it to straight polarity. And in a lot of circumstances, you want straight polarity. For instance, if you're going to start heliarcing, you know, TIG welding, tungsten inert welding, tungsten inert gas welding, you want to keep the heat away from that thing that's in your hand. You don't want to burn up that expensive tungsten rod that you're holding in your hand. You want to keep the heat on the weld surface. So you have that on straight polarity to try to actually keep the heat away from this thing or what's in your hand. So, you know, there's actual purposes for these things. And then there's an AC setting that you can go on to, like I mentioned before. But again, a different rod for a different purpose. Back to you, Dick.
You said the word straight polarity, STRAIGHT or EIGHT, or is it stray, STRAY? We couldn't tell which it was. Second of all, if I put the positive lead on the chunk of steel with a great big grounding clip, and now the rod in my hand is negatively charged, does that mean the welding would flow in the wrong direction? Instead of me consuming the rod, I would be removing steel from the joint that I'm trying to weld. That would be the steel from the joint would now be depositing itself onto the rod. Would the material flow in the wrong direction with reverse polarity? WS2N, K2IW?
Yes, it would be going in the wrong direction. And you don't want that when you're doing a couple of pieces of steel next to one another and you have a slight opening between the two. You want good penetration to get inside. You don't want to, you've got to be able to control this thing. So sometimes you want to be able to burn that up a lot, other times you don't. Depending on the situation, there's a 7018 rod where you want straight polarity. You want more heat on the pipe or to work whatever you're doing. So, but I'm just trying to give you an example of the difference between the rods that will burn up. You can actually physically measure the difference depending on whether you're, you know, on reverse polarity. And yes, straight, like straight is an arrow, or straight polarity is, you know, the reverse of what you're normally doing. If you're doing carbon steel, back to you.
If I had, by mistake, deposited too much material from the welding rod into the joint, and now the joint is a great big ugly blob, and I wanted to re-remove some of that material, by reversing the polarity, is that a method by which I could remove excess welding? Over to you, Paul, WS2N, K2IW.
Now, either way, you would be adding more. Just, you know, one way, it's going to be faster than the other way. But, no, it's not. It's not going to reverse the situation. Now you're stuck. If it's a big, big mess, get out the grinding machine and grind away. If you totally destroyed everything, you better just break out the torch and recut everything. But in most cases, you'll have to break out your grinding equipment and just grind everything down and just redo that area back to the WS.
AC2IS, wait for the beeps, and you got a bill.
Rick, I just had this thought. If you took this piece of braided wire, if you had two of them, and if somehow you could strip all the electrons out of one of them, or maybe just strip one electron per atom or molecule, what have you, in one of your braided cables, and then you brought these two cables together, touch them end to end, I figure there's enough energy there that would transfer so quickly, you probably just vaporize both of those cables. But forgetting about that part of it, if you are somehow able to strip electrons away so easily, which is probably impossible, is there some point, I don't know, I guess we're talking about quantum theory at this point, but do you at some point change the material itself? Is it possible that atoms cannot sustain, you know, existing without their electrons, and do they conceivably become something else? Don't know if there's a way to answer that question, but there you go. There's a question. AC2IS.
We call the element oxygen oxygen because it's got 16 protons and some number of electrons, depending on which isotope it is. So it's got 16 protons in that nucleus. We call it hydrogen because it's got one proton in that nucleus. So what is the material and where is it in the periodic table is determined by the number of protons. You take away one proton and it's now a different material, one step over on the periodic table. That's the way I see it. However, Mother Nature has this huge positive charge off each one of those protons. If you could get close enough to it, the charge on each proton is huge. The charge on each electron, if you can get close enough to it, is huge. And Mother Nature really forces there to be a balance for that. If you've got a copper atom running around, and it's lacking an electron, and it's now positively charged, so to speak, it's going to have a huge attraction for any other stray electron that's nearby. It's going to try to balance that in a hurry. So if we now take the extreme case, Mother Nature's not going to let you do it. But if she would, by some magic, or if you've got some really huge machine of some kind, where you could drain every free electron, the ones that are capable of flowing, and a couple of rods, let me drop. If you could drain every one of those electrons out of one copper rod, and you have another copper rod just like its ordinary, side by side, and you let the two touch, you have to a certain degree on taking every electron away from that first copper rod, you have created the first cousin of antimatter. We know that when matter and antimatter touch each other, the energy that flows creates complete annihilation. You'd have something close to that happening. So those two rods touching each other would be, I think, close to the amount of energy dissipation of matter and antimatter touching each other. That's a guess on my part. That gives you a little bit of an idea of why what you're asking to do, to take all those electrons out of there, is essentially impossible. AC2IS, K2IW, that's a bunch of guesses on my part.
AC2GS?
Yeah, let's put Roy on this one first. Go ahead, Roy.
Yes, thank you, Dick. Well, I can tell you an example of a atom that has had all of its electrons removed. They're called alpha particles, and they happen all over the place. So is possible, not in large collections, but in individuals, you can deionize an atom completely, given enough energy.
And particle accelerators, like the alternating radiant synchrotron, or the Large Hadron Collider, they are starting off with these pure protons, so to speak, and accelerating them. However, the total charge that they're accelerating compared to the total charge that's in that copper braid between your starter motor and that battery, very, very small. I mean, if I added up the total number of electrons I'm capable of draining out of that copper braid, and I add the total number of particles that I'm accelerating in the LHC, I think we've got many orders of magnitude of difference here. That's a guess on my part. Over to you on that one, Roy.
Yes, I agree. The amount of energy required would be ridiculous, and the material wouldn't be able to sustain that amount of energy. But in principle, I think it's nice to know that alpha particles are basically helium atoms that simply have their electrons removed. And I don't think a de-electronified, say, piece of wire, if you could get it to exist for any time in particular, would sustain the same energy release as matter-antimatter collision, because you have to add on not only just the electrostatic reaction, but the mass energy equivalence of the protons and the neutrons involved in the wire, and that would be a couple of orders of magnitude greater. I wouldn't want to be near either of them when they go off, but antimatter would probably give you more bang, though.
So on that spaceship of yours and mine, that containment vessel where the matter and antimatter are kept apart from each other, that's a very important component of the spaceship. And if it starts to fail, and matter and antimatter starts coming together, we're in a heap of trouble. A certain amount of science fiction, Star Trek for instance, particularly the communicators and the phasers. The phasers became light-emitting diodes, and the equivalent of, we could almost make a ray gun out of those, although not quite as portable. But the communicator is a modern-day cell phone and the handy-talkies. So a certain percentage of Star Trek people think that gave us a clue as to what's coming. Somebody made some very good guesses. But beaming down, not a chance. I mean, you who work in medicine know how complicated the DNA is of one single human body cell. And you've got close to a trillion cells in a human being. Can you imagine taking all of that apart, transporting it, and then reassembling it on the other side, beaming down? I don't think we're going to ever see that. That's a guess on my part. AC2GS, K2IW, go ahead, Roy.
Forget about the data rate, forget about the energy requirement, forget about transferring the energy. The thing that kind of makes it incredibly absurd is, if you notice on the TV show, there's almost never a receiver. There's just a transmitter, and then they're on the planet, and they sparkle a little bit, and they reconstitute. So, no. I wrote long ago, that was just Gene Roddenberry couldn't afford to have a shuttlecraft land every episode. So they had to have a cheap scam, and what they did was a nice beam of light and some sparkles and such. Made a great effect.
Yeah, every time you visit a planet, you'd have to be sending a shuttlecraft. And it would be a very boring, repetitive portion of the show. So this beaming down got around that. Even though not even science fiction can really talk about it being anything close to a reality. But among the scientists that you work with, John, if you give them that puzzle of the red electron coming out of the battery, going through that copper braid over to the starter motor, and the starter motor is drawing 200 amperes, on average, how long is it going to take to get there? From one point of view, closing the switch, you getting action in 3 nanoseconds. But in reality, that red electron's going to take 4 hours to get there. Guarantee a high percentage of the scientists you work with will have trouble with that question. Very similar to if you also ask them, what is the mass of 1 cubic meter of the air that's in the room with you right now? To a rough guess, what is the mass in any unit you like, 1 cubic meter of air that's in the room with you right now? You ask anybody, even an aerodynamicist, sometimes you get a wrong answer on that one, but among the average engineer, of the electrical engineers on Long Island, I get an answer of roughly 1 milligram as an answer. And the answer is more than a kilogram. 2.7 pounds per cubic meter is the air that's in the room with you. And we've all got that that experience in our youth of putting the hand out the window when the car is moving 40 miles an hour, and you can feel the weight of that air. Air is very heavy stuff because it's got such low viscosity, and because it's not directly taught in those units in the United States, 99% of the population doesn't know, even to approximate order of magnitude, the mass of 1 cubic meter.
Repeater, timeout.
The mass of 1 cubic meter of air. So back to you, John. I know we got a little bit left of center of your original question, but I thought you'd have some fun with this one. In the week or two next, if you happen to ask either of those questions to your fellow scientists at Los Alamos, I'm very curious as to what their answers are going to be on average.
Coming.
KC2SHO first. K2LIW, go ahead, John.
K2RIW, KC2SHO. Don't apologize for getting left or right of center, or north or south, however you want to look at it. This is what I love about the conversations we have here, the ability to end up in all different directions and learn all kinds of new, interesting things. My apologies for not paying closer attention to the question. I was preparing dinner and eating dinner and doing different things while the net's on here. I was hoping that a little more time would pass before my turn came up. But I realized my error as soon as you guys started talking. And yeah, that's a good question. How many people would get that? I'm pretty sure there's a lot of really smart engineers that I work with. And unless they answer too hastily, I think most of them would get it right. Of course, some of them may actually be able to hear my transmission, so I better give them all the praise that they deserve. One of these days, right now I'm only running a node on the dummy load. One of these days, I'll put it on a real antenna, and maybe some others will join in. I don't know. The ham radio community here, from what I've heard, is not very on-air active, at least not on the local repeaters. So I'm going to figure out where they hang out and what they do. Was there another question there, Dick? Again, sorry I'm not giving my full attention here this evening. K2RIW, KC2SHO.
Yeah, I worked into a company called, for 35 years I worked at a company called Airborne Instruments Laboratory. In their heyday, they had 2,500 engineers, mostly electronic, but quite a few mechanical, and quite a few industrial, quite a few chemical. But 2,500 engineers, very smart people, all with good degrees, carefully chosen. And I knew they were smart people. Yet the uniqueness of the way the American education occurs, an extremely high percentage of them were baffled by the fact that I was asking them, what is the mass of 1 cubic meter of air that's in the room with them right now? I knew they knew how to calculate it. I knew they knew how to look it up. But you ask for an off-the-cuff answer, you'll be amazed what percentage of the answers you get. And the same thing when it comes to that red electron coming out of the battery going to the starter motor. On average, how long does it take to get there? When you ask a few of your fellow smart engineers at Los Alamos, when we come back a week or two from now, I'm kind of curious as to what you're going to find. You might be surprised. Wes, go ahead, K2RIW.
The question isn't so much accurate because you have to take into consideration a temperature and a pressure at given elevation. So somebody could have a room at 200 meters up example, somebody could have a room at sea level. You know, it's a temperature at the room. So, say, at 0 degrees, the pressure per mole occupies 22.4 liters, so the cubic meter of air would be somehow 1.3 kilograms, and that would be the answer. Enter again.
07.
Wes, stand by a minute, John. Wes, I strongly disagree with what you just said. The wording of my question was, what's the approximate mass of 1 cubic meter of air, the stuff that's in the room with us right now? That was the way it was worded. And whether it's hot or cold or high in humidity or lower humidity, we're talking about a 10% increase or decrease. The average engineer guesses 1 milligram. The answer is 1 kilogram. They're wrong on average by a 1,000,000-to-1 ratio. That's the point. The order of magnitude is 6 orders of magnitude of average error of the electronic engineers on Long Island. 75% of them give an answer like that. John, I think you had a comment further. KC2SHO, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
Yeah, real quick, just going back to the red electron in the battery wire question. Is that an on-average kind of thing, or is there a chance that it could find a path that takes less time? Is there some variable to that, or is it pretty fixed? K2RIW, KC2SHO.
When I said the answer was approximately 4 hours, that's for the average width of a copper braid that's grounding your battery to the grounding of the block of the automobile and therefore to the starter motor. If you go through an exact calculation, you may find that for your particular car, which is either 12 volts or 6 volts or whatever, you might get an answer of 3.3 hours or 4.2 hours. We're talking about rough order of magnitude. The total number of steps that that red electron has to take to go through all of those individual copper molecules and eventually get down to that starter motor. We're talking about, I'm going to pick a number out of the air, 10 to the 30 steps, 10 to the 30 power steps. When the number of steps is that large, you and I can talk about an average. And the only thing that's going to make a change is whether or not I've got a fat cable, a skinny cable, a cheap car, a slightly longer cable, a slightly shorter cable, that's going to make a 10%, a 20% change. We're talking about orders of magnitude. The engineer is quite often going to answer 3 nanoseconds, and the answer is 4 hours. That's what? 7 or 8 orders of magnitude of error. That amount of error of a quick, off-the-cuff answer, and the 6 orders of magnitude, in the case of the mass of a cubic meter there, the 6 orders of magnitude is the real point we're making here. The fact that that information is not presented to the average engineer in their school in a palatable manner in their normal education creates that many orders of magnitude of average error. That's why this is a fun thing to do. I've got a few more of these puzzles, which I'll give to you in the future weeks, John. KC2SHO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
On tunneling.
Repeater, timeout.
Go right ahead, John.
Let me take it here. I've got a question. Let me make sure I have it. I want to repose the question in a different way.
Let me make a comment.
Let John finish his statement first. Go ahead, John.
Did the test over and over and over with very fixed pieces. Would the time for that electron always be exactly the same? Is it because of all the electrons in play, does sometimes that electron take a longer path compared to a shorter path through the same medium? Here's another way to pose the question. Let's say I put an enormous conductor, one so big, is it possible that sometimes that particular electron may never get there? K2RIW, KC2SHO.
in the field of statistics, there's something called the central limit theorem. If, for instance, I take very large statistics, if I'm flipping coins to find out how many heads and how many tails I'm going to get, and it's a fair coin, and if I do the experiment 1 million times, I'm going to get very close to 500,000 heads and 500,000 tails. Central limit theorem tells me that when I've got very large statistics, I can make a pretty good prediction as to what the average is going to be. The total number of steps that an electron has to take, if it doesn't do any tunneling, and if it doesn't find a short circuit, and doesn't do any arcing or whatever, it's going to be, I'm going to pick a number out of there, 10 to the 31 power steps for the electron to take. And he's got a continuous potential difference, the voltage drop across that cable, giving him a very strong bias as to what direction he wants to go. He's not going to go in the opposite direction. He's got a very strong bias to go forward. He's got 10 to the 31 steps to go through before he gets there. And you average 10 to the 31 steps, you're going to get very close to the predictable average, assuming we haven't drastically changed the diameter or the length of the cable or the current that's flowing. That's my guess on this one, John. KC2SHO for a final on this one. K2LIW. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, very, very good, Dick. I guess there's still a question in my mind. Is it possible for the electron to enter the conductor from the energy source, the battery, and then just because of the path it takes to never really come out of there, because there could be so many other electrons in the case of a very large, oversized conductor for what you need, is there some possibility that it just never makes it out the other side, or sometimes takes a more direct path, you know? Still trying to just chew on that, I guess. Anyway, real good. We don't have to get too much further on it tonight. This definitely gives me something to think about. And I will ping some of the engineers at work and see how that works out. If they don't get too angry with me for asking them questions like that. K2RIW, thank you so much. Always appreciate the information and this wonderful net. KC2SHO, Los Alamos, New Mexico.
WS2N comments.
You're third on the list to make comments, Paul. Yes, you've hit something, the nail on the head. First of all, the amount of forward bias that each electron feels in that cable is very close to the same. In other words, the voltage drop for each inch of cable is very predictable. Therefore, the amount of attraction each electron has to go in the forward direction, they're all the same. And when you've got that many steps, it's going to average out. If you have any doubt on this, instead of talking about one electron, make it a bulk, make it a little cube of 100 electrons. And now you're going to average the amount of time for the 100 electrons to get through the cable. There's various ways you can get around that one. There's another point I was going to make along these lines with central limit theorem. But you got the point. But the orders of magnitude of difference between the prediction and the reality. We're not talking about the 10% change because of temperature, humidity, when it comes to air, and the slightly fatter and the slightly shorter and whatever cable. N2XJN, you wanted to make a comment. K2LIW, go ahead, Wes.
First, I would like to ask you a question. What is the mass of 1 cubic meter of air at sea level and 0 degrees?
Very close to 1.1 kilogram over the U.S.
1.293 kilograms, that's what I answered. I probably didn't understand the question, so would you be so kind and repeat the question, or we can ask Dr. Roy for translation and to actually.
I said, on average, what's the approximate weight of 1 cubic meter of air, the stuff that's in the room with us right now? And by the way, you said for 0 degrees. You and I don't live in 0 degrees centigrade air. We live in 23 degrees centigrade air and so on. Roy, I know you want to make a comment on all of the above. AC2GS, K2LIW.
Okay, I just wanted to point out that electron drift is an averaging. It's theoretically possible that one electron in the trillions and trillions and trillions in the lattice of a metal conductor will just stay in place and not be pushed along. But again, it's all an average, and I think nitpicking of whether or not one electron stays or goes, or electron tunneling occurs, is kind of missing the big picture.
During the time that 200 amperes is flowing in that cable, there's a certain number of millivolts of drop across that cable. Every single inch of that cable has a certain amount of potential difference from end to end that's creating a field, an electric field, that pushes that electron, that attracts that electron. That electron's not going to sit still. You can't get an electron for 4 solid hours to sit still when he feels that forward bias current. By the same token, I could say that I turn on my garden hose, I open up the faucet, and you're going to tell me one of those drops of water is going to sit right at the faucet where all the other drops of water move down the hose? Are you going to tell me that that's possible and that we should really discuss the probability of that happening? AC2GS, K2RIW, defend yourself, Roy, go ahead.
Yes, I would say exactly that, because although copper is a great conductor, it is not a perfect conductor. And so there are small inconsistencies in the electron cloud. It's a delocalized electron cloud in the outer orbital that gives copper its great conductance. But other than superconductors, nothing is perfect. So there's always that probabilistic case of the sticky electron, in my humble opinion.
I'd rather have a copper be an imperfect copper, imperfect conductor. That means it has a certain number of volts dropped across the total length, and that voltage drop across the length represents a kind of a potentiometer. And as long as I've got reasonably uniform copper, we don't have some of it copper and some of it lead, if you know what I mean. I got reasonably uniform copper with a nearly constant volts per inch drop across that imperfect copper. That gives me a strong bias from the majority of those electrons to be pushed in one particular direction. And I've got central limit theorem in my favor here, because I've got a very large number of steps for that electron to go, every one of those electrons to go through before it can go from one end to the other. 10 to the 31 steps is the number I came up with, and we'll soon find out, is that number high or low. Paul, you want to make a question or a comment? WS2N, K2RIW. Go ahead, Paul.
Yes, in regard to the electrons making it from one end to the other, there's a good book. I believe you have the book, Thinking Physics. And there's one section in there talking about the sale of electrons. And this guy explains that, you know, a lot of people think, well, the power plant comes on, electrons go flying through the wire into your house and then back to the power plant. But because of what's going on, the electrons that are in your house, they never even leave the house. It's AC by the time it gets to your house. It's going back and forth 60 times a second. None of the electrons are ever making it back to the plant. In fact, they're still in your house. The only thing they're charging you for in your electric bill is the movement of the same electrons in your house. They're not going anywhere. They're just staying there, just going back and forth. So they never, in a lot of cases, they never make it back to the source. Back to the...
Very good, Paul. I'm glad you brought that to our attention. In the case of a starter motor, on a realistic day, you and I run that starter motor for about 1 second or so. In that 1 second of even 200 amperes of flow on a cold winter day with a locked rotor in the beginning, the majority of those electrons in that cable get a chance to move not even a 16th of an inch. The majority of those electrons in that cable probably only move a 16th of an inch during the time that you draw 200 amperes into that starter motor to start your car. In the case of the current that's flowing, the 30 amperes of AC current that's flowing into your house, into your fuse panel, at 120 or 240 volts, the majority of those electrons are wiggling back and forth 60 times per second, and I bet you they only move a thousandth of an inch or so. They're wiggling back and forth, so you got a whole bunch of marbles in the pipe. You got this pipe between your house and the power station, so to speak. It's going through transformers and all kinds of jazz, but you got this pipe. and the electrons in that pipe are wiggling back and forth. Energy is transmitted. But, yes, you're absolutely right. A hell of a lot of those people think the electrons leave your house, go back to the power station, and come back to your house on the positive half cycle. They probably only move a thousandth of an inch, wiggling back and forth. And we can calculate how far they move now that we know some of the specifics of what we're looking for. Glad you brought it to our attention, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Okay, very good. Yeah, sure. And then you get DC situation on your car, you know, you're going to move the electrons, but that's it. You're going to shut it off, and they'll still be roughly in the same spot. They didn't move far.
Now, you have a number of ways of looking at the situation. You could say all the electronic engineers are not going to get this right, and therefore they're dumb. Absolutely not. They're a victim of our educational system. We're talking about a very practical, common-sense kind of approach at science and physics education. The material is not presented in this manner. I have collected 30 puzzles of this nature. And when I give any of these 30 puzzles, and you've now heard two of them, to my fellow engineers, some of them get angry because they think it's displaying their ignorance. It's not at all displaying their ignorance. It's displaying an error in the or a hole in the educational system. The typical educational system presents certain, I'm going to call them common sense holes. And therefore, using common sense and the way we're given the information, the way we're given Maxwell's equations as a way of explaining how an antenna works, it's accurate, it's very scientific, it's very, what's the word for it, quantitative, but it lacks an awful lot of common sense. When you get a real antenna application requirement, so you need an antenna that squeezes into this particular, let me drop it. You need an antenna that squeezes into this particular corner of a cell phone, and it's going to operate at these five different frequencies. The LTE band, the 800 meg band, the 900 meg band, the 2100 meg band, the 5.2 gig band, and the 1700 meg band for global positioning satellite. You're going to make an antenna that works on all of those frequencies. So that's the requirement. And you're given some number of cubic centimeters and some number of square centimeters of printed circuit board space, and maybe it's a five-layer board in which to do this. And on the other side of the page, somebody has written down all of the Maxwell's equations in the integration form, the differential form, and whatever. And you look at the left-hand page, and you look at the right-hand page, and you think that the data you have been given in your electrical engineering course is going to allow you to form a solution. Absolutely not. That engineer that designs that antenna that goes into that cell phone is using a whole bunch of rules of thumb that he's acquired over the last 20 years of his experience of working under the wing of a white-haired guy that taught him the art and science of antenna engineering. That's where the real information that gets applied to the real problem, that's where it's coming from. And the educational process by which we're given that raw data is not in useful engineering form. That's my point. Not everyone's going to agree with me, and I understand that. I have a friendly comment on all of the above. K2RIW in the TechNet. Roy, you've got a number of interesting questions that were presented to you by way of the mailbag this week. Choose any one of them, and please proceed with the physics science section, which we sort of entered, and now we're going to more formally enter it. AC2GS, with the physics science talk, K2RIW in TechNet. Go ahead, Dr. Roy.
Okay, Dick, I have basically two questions from the mailbag. One of them is your basic meat and potatoes amateur radio. The other is a little bit on the blue sky amateur radio. Do you feel like discussing the present or the future?
The choice is purely yours, Roy. Whichever you choose, we're going to appreciate it.
Hey, we'll do the present, and at some point later we'll talk about the future. The question is, what I don't understand is why solar flares or CMEs cause a radio blackout. I figured the extra charged particles would make the MUF higher. Is it greater increased D-layer absorption? So So this gentleman wants to know why solar flares and CMEs, who he compares to the sunspot cycle, isn't improving propagation the way sunspots do.
Now, I think you've thrown this out to the group, and you'd like the group to offer speculations, potential answers, or real answers that they've acquired by which their reading and experience has occurred. Is that sort of what you're doing, Roy? You're asking for people to volunteer an answer from their experience? Over to you, Roy.
I open it up to anyone that wants to comment, and especially yourself, because you know a hell of a lot more about propagation than many of us.
Yeah, I've got a very limited experience, though. When it comes to propagation from 432 megahertz and above, I've got a fair amount of experience, real hardcore decades of experience. I am not an HF operator, and this was primarily an HF question. 3 to 30 megacycles was really the frequency region, I believe, of the question that's asked. I've got some guesses as to what goes on there, but you guys who have used the 3 to 30 megacycle region for lots and lots of years, you HF guys, you DC banders, that's a slang on my part. The microwavers call you guys that work below 100 megacycles, they're called DC banders. And the guys that work on 160 meters, they're called the top banders. Although nowadays we've even got 630 meter band, but you know what I mean. I hope some of you HF people are going to give an answer to that question. Please give your call letters right now, K2RIW and AC2GS listening.
That's Ian.
Go right ahead, Bell West.
I understood probably the question. The flare ejects clouds of electrons, ions, and atoms along with the electromagnetic waves. As photons cannot interact with another photons, the only particles could probably disturb the communication. Am I right?
You might be, but I'm going to use different words and re-explain what I think you've just said. We know that depending on the sunspot cycle, you get long and short skip distances. You get all kinds of articles you can look up where people make prediction that we think the sunspot is going to be this number of sunspots a week from now. Therefore, during the daytime, during the nighttime, the 80-meter band is going to open to these particular regions and not to those particular regions. So your skip distances, the rate at which the rate at which your radio wave hits the ionosphere and either bends sharply or softly, and therefore what is your skip distance and how many hops is there going to be between New York and London, that changes drastically depending on what the sun is doing today. So I think that's part of the answer. That's a guess on my part. I wonder if you think that's close, Roy. AC2GS, K2RIW, the TechNet.
I'm not quite sure. Maybe I should just kind of give a brief description of how ionospheric propagation takes place, and maybe that will kind of help to ease the problem a bit.
That sounds awful good. Go right ahead, Roy.
Okay, historically, there are a number of bands of the ionosphere. For some odd reason, again, because physics works in mysterious ways, you'd think they'd make it A, B, and C, but they didn't. They made it D, E, and F. D is the one closest to the Earth and the most likely to cause problems. When the D ionosphere gets energized by the sun, it produces it blocks the lower frequencies, and that's why lower frequency 160 band and 80 band is awful during the day, because the D ionosphere is energized. Then there's the E, which is good for medium frequency HF, and then there's the F, which when it becomes highly energized separates into F1 and F2, and that's where the fun starts. with the sunspot cycles, the F1 and the F2 produce enough refraction so that higher frequencies refract back and propagate. If they don't, they go right through it, refracting not enough to reflect and go out. The trouble with coronal discharges and the CMEs is that they are so violent that not only do they ionize the ionosphere, they disrupt the layers completely into a mishmash so that there is nothing uniform about them. It's like trying to do optics in a cloudy lens.
I like that, and I'm going to add a few words to it, Roy. And you're allowed to say you agree or disagree with what I'm about to say. The D layer is the one that's much lower, closer to the Earth. The air density there, the number of molecules per cubic centimeter, is much, much higher. Therefore, when the...
Repeater, time out.
Therefore, when they become ionized, they become very absorptive. It's a little bit like a volumetric attenuator. So they become very absorptive. The D layer is effective at high noon, particularly, because the sun is beating down with its ultraviolet rays, ionizing the D layer material. The D layer material is very dense, becomes ionized, partially conductive, resistive, and absorptive. And it's a dissipative energy layer. As soon as the sun sets, because the molecules are so close to each other, the recombination that gets rid of the ionization happens very rapidly. You get essentially no D layer at nighttime because the recombination has occurred in a hurry. So the D layer is very absorptive at, say, for instance, 80 meters. I can remember at high noon, my full power out of my transmitter, I could barely talk on 80 meters to the guy one town away with my simple dipole antenna. Whereas at nighttime, I could talk to California on 80 meters, if you know what I mean, when the D layer was not there. So that particular layer, that's one way of explaining. You call it blockage, I would call it absorption. Before we go to the next layer, see if you agree or disagree on some of that, Roy. AC2GS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, I pretty much agree. You know, semantics is always a problem. The nuance that I get in the literature is not that it's purely, it's attenuating, but they seem to describe it as not purely absorption, but partially negative reinforcement of the wave front. So it's a complex phenomenon, fortunately.
When I launch a wave into the D layer, and I want to talk to a guy 10 miles away on 80 meters, and we've got direct line of sight path between us, he does not hear me. I call that absorption and dissipation because I can't choose any other direction where the signal went. It didn't bounce back to me. I launched it. It got radiated. My antenna presented the same 70 ohm impedance on my dipole it normally does. I put 100 watts into it. 100 watts got radiated from that dipole. It went into that D layer. And the guy 10 miles away with direct line of sight does not hear me. Is that blockage? Is that absorption? I can't choose any direction where it went. If I did a very scientific experiment, I'll bet you I could measure the amount of heating of that D layer of air if I had a sensitive enough piece of instrumentation. I think it is volumetric absorption and dissipation. That's my guess. Over to you, Roy. K2RIW.
I think ultimately what we'd be quibbling about is whether something is 90% or 80% or 70%. Because apparently in the literature there is some degree of interference occurring, whether it's because it's reflecting off the initial layer of the D layer and the DF layer, and for some odd reason at around 80 meters and 160 meters, it's enough to interfere subtractively or not. I don't know the details, but it seems to be in the literature a lot about how there is a inherent negative reinforcement in addition to the absorption. And also I might bring out that these solar flares and such generate their own amount of RF, pure and simple, that completely jam a lot of signals, even beyond the concept of propagation distortion.
WB2HWW.